The Dharma, incomparably profound and exquisite, is rarely met with even in hundreds of thousands of millions of kalpas. We now can see it, hear it, accept and hold it. May we realize the true mind of the Tathagata. Today is day 6 of this November 2014 session here at Mountain Gate. And we have just about, actually less than a day and a half left in session. So dive in deeper than you've gone yet so far. This is important. As we've said earlier, the fact that you've been sitting all these days up till now means that your capacity is greater for going deeper, for becoming more open, for becoming more clear. So take advantage of that. I'd like to share with you again more of the teachings of Kusan Sunim, the Korean Sun master who lived in the 1900s and was a very well-known, highly respected Zen master, Sun master, as they call him in Korean, the Korean version of Zen. This is from the book, The Way of Korean Zen. And today we will take up again something of one of his talks during the 90-day retreat that they have periodically at the Korean Zen temples. I would like to recount to you an incident that occurred to me in the year in which I became a monk, which was 1938. I had just spent the summer meditation season in Samil Am Meditation Hall at Songkwang Sa with 22 other monks. It had been a fruitful season, since I had put a great deal of effort into my practice to the point where I no longer cared whether I lived or died. During this time, I had become a friend in the way with a monk called Pak San Sunim. He was a very serious meditator. Even while walking, he would keep his eyes half closed and never look around him because he was looking inward. In the old days in the Rochester Zen Center when Kepler Roshi was in charge, that was what we did as well. We kept our eyes down at all times, no matter whether we were in session or not. It didn't matter. And of course, there was absolutely no talking, absolutely no talking. And this was all to enhance our possibilities for coming sooner to Kensho, to awakening. And I kind of hesitate to call Kensho awakening, although it is an awakening, a partial awakening, we would say, really, because to be truly 100% awake takes a great deal more than one Kensho. And of course, we are in this for lifetimes here at Mountain Gate. We're not going to just come to a session and then assume we've got it and go back into our daily life and hang out. People here are very serious about practice, and that is very, very important. And unless we are serious about practice, there's not a great deal we can do in terms of going very deep because we're not committed to it. We're not truly feeling a need to do so. And this is why for many, many years there was absolutely no information about Mountain Gate on the net. It was only a few years back that we finally put up a website. It is because it was felt that if people really needed to find us, they would find us. And that is what has happened. The most serious people, thankfully, have come here and been really ready to practice. And that is what it takes to come to any level of awakening. When the free season arrived, and this needs a little bit of explanation. Korean Sun apparently is practiced in the following way. much like it was in ancient China, that monks and nuns would gather at a particular monastery for a training period, a 90-day training period, it seems like was common. And then between training periods, they would be free to travel wherever they wanted to go. And essentially what they did is they would go to other monasteries who were also in the so-called free period and do practice there. And then settle down at a given monastery for the entire length of the practice retreat. And then again, next time the free period came, some monks would stay in that same place, but most of them apparently would travel and work on deepening their practice in the midst of activity, plus in the testing of it in other environments and other temples. So, when the free season arrived, Pak San Sunim and myself decided to leave Songhwan Sa and go elsewhere to continue our practice. This is not considered running away. This is considered a way of working in the Korean way of working on Son practice. However, Soktu Sunim, the teacher of my own teacher, had recently asked me to stay and be his attendant. Thus, I was of two minds as to what I should do. One morning, immediately after breakfast, Pak San Sunim decided to leave. Although I wanted to go with him, I felt that I should heed the request of Soktu Sunim. So he left alone. The morning passed, and having given much thought to my predicament, by lunchtime I decided that it would have been better, after all, if I had left. So shortly after lunch, I put my knapsack on my back and left to follow Pak San Sunim. To catch up with my friend, I had to reach Taien Sa Temple near the town of Koksong, which was about 70 li, which is the equivalent of 30 kilometers, away. I walked steadily during the afternoon, but as night fell, there were still 10 li to go. Not knowing the way, I decided to spend the night in a nearby village. During the night, I began to feel very ill. A sudden sickness may have been due to the fact that I'd simply overexerted myself. Throughout the summer, I had strenuously pursued my practice and, with hardly a break, had just walked 60 li in one afternoon carrying a heavy knapsack. The next morning, after the villagers had given me something to eat, I nevertheless continued on my way in spite of the illness. However, my body was racked with pain, and with much difficulty, it took me the entire morning to cover the remaining 10 li. I finally reached Taien Sa at midday. I met Pak San Sunim at the gate of the temple. He had eaten lunch and was just about to leave for a short walk. Instead, he welcomed me inside. Then, after eating lunch, I had to lie down because the pain in my body was still causing me. For the rest of the afternoon, I was able to rest. By then, it had started raining, and we were unable to go out anyway. However, my illness persisted through the night and into the following morning. By early morning, the rain finally cleared up, but I still felt too sick to continue traveling that day and thought it better to stay in the temple to rest. Shortly, a note came to us from the temple administration announcing that the rain had stopped. This is a code. This obviously meant that the monks in the temple thought it was time for us to leave. After discussing this matter with Pak San Sunim, we realized that we had no choice but to go. Because I felt so weak and ill, I was at first rather reluctant to set out upon the road, but my friend explained that it would be most troublesome for us to stay any longer. You have to remember that the situation in the temples was quite different in those days from what it is now. This was a time when married priests were in charge of most of the temples. And that is, there was a great schism in Korean Son with two competing sects, one that felt that their priests or their monks should be married, and the other sect that they felt it was important to keep the traditional celibacy associated with the monkhood. And these two different groups were quite definitely at odds with each other. There's a lot that's written about this. It became quite a challenge to Korean Son. Nowadays, if a meditating monk wished to stay in an extra day because he was too sick to travel, the temple administration could never object. But then it was not possible for us meditators to challenge anything that the married priests said. So now I started to reflect upon my situation. For more than a day, I had been literally moaning in illness. My whole body, from the top of my head to the soles of my feet, was in pain. However, I thought, a monk practices in order to attain liberation from birth and death and should not be upset by physical pain. And in reality, where was this pain that had been causing me such suffering? Where was it located? In this way, I carefully searched throughout my body for the place of illness. While pursuing this inner search for the pain, I suddenly realized that there was no single place where any pain was located. Although I had scrutinized my entire body from head to toe, I could find no particular pain anywhere. Thereupon, I was immediately cured. Straight away, I sprang to my feet and told Paksan Sanim that I was now completely cured and we could continue on our way. However, at that moment, the bell was rung for lunch, so we stayed to eat and left shortly after the meal. That afternoon, we walked without difficulty to the town of Koksong and spent the night at the temple in the town. The next day, too, we continued on our journey. This account illustrates how important it is for a meditator to maintain a firm hold on their mind. This is the duty of every cultivator of the way. A mind is as wily as a fox and as mischievous as a goblin. If we just let it be, it will give rise to all kinds of different thoughts and all kinds of different ideas and stories and illusions. And that's what they are, stories. We reach a very important milestone in our practice when we begin to realize that we cannot trust our thoughts. We cannot trust what comes up in our mind. And indeed we can't, because this is the stuff of conditioning. This is the stuff bred of assumptions we've made based on how we've been treated and the experiences that have happened to us as we've grown up. It's all stories. And given that we are misperceiving a great deal of the time as a result of seeing what goes on outside us, seemingly outside us, and within us through the lens of our conditioning and our assumptions, then how do we become free of this? How do we become free of this? It is exactly these stories and assumptions and this conditioning that causes people grief, because they take it to be the true person and they react out of that assumption. But who are we really? Where is that true person of no rank coming in and out of the doors of our senses that Rinzai talks about? There's a true person of no rank coming in and out of the doors of your senses. If you haven't seen it yet, see it now. See it now. And in seeing it, we become free of those stories, of those ideas, of that conditioning. Little by little, the deeper we go in our practice. And we're more able to tune in to where the truth can be experienced, which is really coming from our hara. If you want to say something about any kind of location, there can be a sense when we are let go enough that if we tune into that sense, it will lead us in the correct direction, in the absolutely right direction. We can trust it, but we have to be careful, because the mind can create an illusion of that sense so that we think it's that depth of understanding that we're moving from, when actually it is our ideas about ourselves that are driving it. It sounds a little bit hopeless, but actually it's not, because we have some incredible practice tools to use to ferret out the truth, to cut through the delusion, to cut through the stories, to see through the idea of some self that we've been carrying around like a heavy weight on our back, reacting from, protecting, defending, getting embarrassed because of, coming to grief because of. Who are we really? This is the fundamental question of our practice. And of course, we have many different ways of approaching that question. We have the breakthrough koans. Who am I? Show me your face before your parents were born. What is mu? The sound of one hand. Who is it? What is this? Those are the basic breakthrough koans. But there's a more potent one, potentially, because whatever brought us to practice really is our own koan. And if it's strong enough, we can use the yearning, the need to know, to drive that out-breath far out, so that eventually we reach that place of clarity, which is a space between thoughts. And we open to it more fully, expand our awareness of it continually. And at a certain point, it will break open and we will cross that invisible threshold into Kensho. And of course, as you've heard so many times here, then it's important to both deepen and expand that opening as well as bring it to life in your daily life. And all along the way, before we even get to that point, each time we give ourselves completely, fully to the breath, we are weakening the habit patterns of tenacious hold on this illusory self-image. We are opening more and more to the unknown, the unborn. And gradually, little by little, if we persist, we are freeing ourselves from that monkey on our back. This account illustrates how important it is for a meditator to maintain a firm hold on their mind. This is the duty of every cultivator of the way. The mind is as wily as a fox and as mischievous as a goblin. If we just let it be, it will give rise to all kinds of different thoughts. And sooner or later, it's going to be one that's going to cause us suffering. One should not allow this to happen. Instead, if we make a firm decision in our minds, all delusive thoughts can be washed away. In this way, those of us who claim to practice meditation should keenly poise our minds like a very sharp dagger. Thus should we bear ourselves with wisdom. Then he continues, to succeed in the practice of meditation, you must raise the final resolve. So what is this final resolve? It is true that all of you here have left your families with the resolve to cultivate your minds. So now you carry the knapsack of a monk and spend your lives in the meditation hall. But this is just ordinary resolve. It is not what is meant by the final resolve. And of course here he's talking to a hall full of monks, of ordained monks. There aren't so many ordained monks in America. And even the ordination situation is very different in America from how it was traditionally. And the whole training aspect is very different up to a point. And the practice is the same, generally speaking. But the way of going about it is different because most American Zen practitioners are lay practitioners. They have jobs, work, home, families, and responsibilities out there and about as a result of all that. So they cannot simply come and spend their lives in a monastery doing practice all day long. That means that the practice has to be more committed to because it's going to be more difficult. Hakuin has said in a number of different places. Practice in the midst of activity is 10,000 times, 10,000 times that valuable over seated zazen. But in truth, we need both. To be a lay practitioner is very difficult because you're having to balance all these other aspects of your life. You're not living in a situation where the whole schedule and the whole environment is set up specifically to help people practice. And so, it's necessary to work harder to keep the mind focused, to keep the practice going when there are moments when that can happen, and to be able to take the time to come to Sesshin where you can make a concerted, concentrated effort over a period of time to deepen your practice. Lay people have chosen a very difficult way to practice, but that seems to be the way it is these days for most people in Zen. But the good news is that exactly because of how difficult it is and the greater degree of commitment that one has to put forth to come to awakening, that awakening can be deeper. As long as we have the resolve, as long as we have the commitment, as long as we keep doing the practice with that commitment, not lackadaisically, but truly, because we don't have very much time in a given day with work and all the rest of our responsibilities, what little time we have to devote to sitting zazen on the cushion, we need to make it really count. We don't dare do anything less than that, because life is short. And if we truly want to come to awakening in this lifetime, it takes great effort. It takes great commitment. The final resolve is to completely sever all concerns about life and death so that you no longer care whether you live or die. With such a resolve, a meditator just sticks the two words life and death to their forehead and, grinding their teeth, perseveres with the practice. And I would hesitate to say grinding the teeth, but that's a metaphor for really, really, really digging in. It doesn't mean developing a lot of body tension and straining. It means relaxing, allowing the mind to sink deep, pulling it away from any extraneous thoughts, pulling it away from ideas, pulling it away from stories, pulling away from dreams, pulling away from thoughts of the future or the past, pulling it away, focusing again and again and again on the practice. And each time we do that, as we said before, it weakens the automatic, habitual way of using our mind and begins to move us into a more open way of using our mind. And a deeper level of commitment and more concentration and more focus and more awareness in our practice. When so determined, this person casts aside the body just as they would throw a stone into the gutter. Why is it necessary to exert such effort? Because the Buddhas and patriarchs of the past, as well as the wise teachers of today, have all said the same thing, namely, every sentient being is intrinsically a Buddha. Every sentient being is intrinsically a Buddha. Not can become one, but is intrinsically a Buddha. We're already endowed with that great perfection, that depth of compassion, transcendental wisdom. But, of course, because we've covered it up unwittingly with all of our assumptions and all of our conditioning and all of our stories, we don't see it. We can't act out of it. And so we plunder our way through through life, stumbling and having moments of peace and happiness and a lot more moments of challenge. Every sentient being is intrinsically a Buddha. But reflecting on yourselves now, do you have the confidence to truly say that you're a noble and enlightened Buddha? Is there anyone here who would claim to be a Buddha? If you feel you're not yet a Buddha, this means that the downfall of the six thieves is still to take place. All things in the external world that pass through the six sense doors are like thieves who are intent on cheating you. The six sense doors are eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, and mind. Because when perceptions come into our senses, we then take them and build a story around them. That's the mind sense. They continuously deceive you and drag you here and there. We look at a person and we see an expression on their face and we cast it in a particular color based on our assumptions about ourselves. And all manner of pain and suffering comes forth as a result of that. We assume somebody is denigrating us when it may have nothing to do with us. They may be worried about something in their own lives, and so the expression on their face is such that we assume that they're angry at us or they're thinking negatively about us, when that's not at all the case. It's really important to realize this because we cause ourselves a lot of grief on our self-interpretations of what other people's motives are. Unless you ask that person, what are you feeling right now? What are you thinking right now? You cannot accurately assume anything about it. And in fact, we can't even accurately assume anything about our own thoughts and motivations, because we're usually acting out of our conditioning, out of that story we tell about ourselves, and then we wonder why people are reacting the way they are to us. And it's because we didn't hear the tone of voice that we spoke to them with. We're not aware of our attitude towards them. They come straight out of our own conditioning. And so we live with moments of peace and joy and happiness and a whole lot of the rest. Here we have a practice. This extended out-breath, allowing our breath to fall out naturally, and then when it is just about to ready to come back in again, we push it farther out. And this requires focus and concentration, and it also requires letting go of that tenacious self-image, that precious idea of who we are. And we push it farther out. And we reach through that breath in search of who we really are, in search of the real truth. And when we do it enough and reach far enough, that truth will appear before us. And it will be amazing and yet at the same time totally and completely ordinary. And for however long or short a period of time, we will feel totally free. And we will be able to live that freedom. And then the old habit patterns will come rolling back in. And that's when the real work begins. They'll be weakened. So it'll be easier to see through them and not indulge in them anymore. And each time they're not indulged in, they weaken further. And if we persist, eventually they just disappear. But it takes hard work. It takes sincere effort. It takes commitment. It takes a willingness to let go life and death. Because what we assume is life is the story of ourself. And in letting it go, there's a sense of dying often. There's a sense of disappearing. And that's essential in order to truly become free of it. We have to experience what it's like without it. Long enough, deeply enough, that it can be anchored so that we can continue working to expand and deepen our awareness of that fundamental truth. This is our practice. And we have really little more than a day left in this session. You've worked hard. Put that extra effort into it. Give everything. Everything to your practice. Truly commit. Truly commit. When we commit 100% to our practice, then it's easy. The difficulty up to that time is because we haven't been 100% committed. We've been 98%, 99%, 99.5%, 99.9%, but that little fraction of percent left is like an escape hatch. And as long as that is looming in our practice, it's going to be difficult. So give yourself. Let it all go. One day, this body isn't going to be viable anyway. Why hang on to it so desperately? Just yesterday, four University of New Mexico students were riding in a car in Old Town Albuquerque, and a guy high on drugs T-boned them and killed two of them. Young people in the prime of life, families devastated. How long will we live? Do you really know? How long will you have the chance to practice? Do you really know that? Even if you live a long life, things happen to people. One of our students in California had a stroke. Her husband sent back to the center. Most of her center effects. There's a sense that at least he doesn't think she can practice anymore. How will it be when the light of your eyes is falling? Will you be like the crab with its seven arms and eight legs struggling to get out of the boiling water? Or will it be simply a peaceful, truly profoundly peaceful, not breathing in again, letting go, at ease with the universe? That is up to you. Thank you for listening. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.